Welcome to Vault 33, a podcast for Amazon Prime's Fallout. We are your hosts, Andrew Sarcini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Onofawakan.
We just watched the third episode of Fallout entitled The Head. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk. Before we do, follow us on Twitter at FalloutVault33. Add us on iTunes, Spotify, and all the other streaming services. Like us, please leave us a review. That's how we get noticed. But of course, the best thing you can do is spread the word to your friends. So this episode was written by Jennifer Robertson-Dworet and Graham Wagner and directed by Jonathan Nolan. This, by the way, this has been the creative lineup for the last, for the first three episodes. And I think after this, it mixes it up. So this will be the last time we'll see the showrunners, Jennifer Robertson-Dworet and Graham Wagner writing solely, and then Jonathan Nolan directing. So
right, which also means it's like you can expect a change in tone in the next episode. And also in the beginning, I think we were like, well, Jonathan Nolan's kind of just, you know, him and his wife, you know, Lisa Joy are, you know, they're not in the day-to-day. But clearly with this direction, he was very involved
for sure
with how the story's being told. And that's exciting, you know, because it's more than just, you know, it's one thing when you've got this person or this couple that is like doing everything. They're the showrunners and they're doing the writing and they're doing the directing. Right. But it's another thing when they can say, all right, this is your story. I'm going to use my talent to do some telling of it to set the tone, and then I'm going to give it back to you. And I think that's really impressive, actually.
Well, Dwayne, why don't you kick us off with a recap of this episode?
All right. We begin with something we saw in episode one, title cards. The episode opens up with one called The Beginning. We're transported back to the time just before the nuclear disaster that started the post-apocalyptic world. Cooper is acting on set, and his character is called to kill an enemy rather than simply arrest him or redeem him. He's a sheriff in kind of a howdy-doody kind of way. And killing him would, you know, arresting him would be more in keeping with his character. Cooper learns that the normal writer has been fired because he was identified as a communist. And that in this new film, his character is meant to highlight Cooper's individuality in order to separate the studio from any perception that it has ties to communism. We jump to Maximus, who's out of his armor and repairing his suit in the town of Philly. He has to sell a tooth to get a component of his suit fixed. When he returns to the suit to get going, he's confronted by a gang who wants the suit for themselves, and he's forced to kill for the first time. He also takes out the radio, cutting off communication with the Brotherhood, who sends him a new squire, Thaddeus, one of the aspirants that used to bully him back at headquarters. Maximus hazes Thaddeus with impossible tasks like trying to get an apple out of a dead tree. Meanwhile, Lucy is traveling with Dr. Wilczek's head. She doesn't quite understand the reason it's so important, but she puts a tracker in it so that she can follow it with her Pip-Boy should it get lost. She comes across a lake where she's attacked by a beast called a gulper from the water. She loses Wilczek's head when the beast takes it and eats it. Before she can go after it, she's captured by Cooper the Ghoul and taken prisoner. Cooper the Ghoul understands that the gulpers digest slowly, and he uses her for bait to catch the gulper so he can catch the head, which hasn't been digested yet. The gulper goes after Lucy, but it overwhelms Cooper the Ghoul. And he's not only unable to capture or kill it, it destroys the medicine he needs to stay intact. Back to Maximus and Thaddeus. Thaddeus is able to track Cooper the Ghoul with a radiation tracking device. They find the gulper rather than Cooper, and they work together to defeat it. They also retrieve Wilczek's head. Back at the vault, Vault 33, Chet, Lucy's cousin and Norm's cousin, is reassigned from his gatekeeper duties for opening the gate and letting Lucy out. We learn that Lucy's brother Norm is reassigned to feeding the captured raiders at the vault incarcerated. The vault is recovering from the attack and doesn't quite know what to do with the prisoners they captured during the raid. The council is also without an overseer and thus becomes a bit ineffective. Openly, the council sparks a controversial plan to rehabilitate the prisoners and turn them into vault citizens over the next few years. In private, it's clear that more than a few citizens would like to dispatch the vault prisoners. We also know that there's a problem with the water management system, which means only 2 months of water remains for the vaulters, and that doesn't include their prisoners. At the end of the episode, we find out that the suit Cooper's wife Barb gives him is a Vault-Tec suit, like the ones Lucy and other vault dwellers wear. He puts it on to record a commercial, the same one we saw in the trailers for the show. We also see that he's the source of the iconic thumbs up of our icon for the Bolt Tech people. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, so I thought this was a fantastic episode. I want to go around the table briefly and ask you, I'll start with you, Dwayne. What's your general opinion about this episode?
There was a lot of character building.
Yeah.
I think they did a good job not making the plot, like for instance, when I had to recap it, it was quick, right? Because the plot doesn't like do a lot of things, but it's mostly how characters interact with one another. I loved the return to the vault. I was missing the vault. Mm-hmm. I think that the characters in the vault have a lot to offer, especially because, you know, now that Lucy and her father aren't there, and it's not running smoothly, they have to interact with one another, and they have these interesting, you know, it's kind of like this Midwest nice stereotype that they've got going for them, and they have to deal with their conflict with the veneer of this niceness, and that just makes for a great thing, especially because you have these, you know, uncouth wild people in their reading room that's been repurposed as a jail. So seeing how they deal, it's kind of like, I don't know if you guys ever saw Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but if you were to watch all the Next Generation era Star Trek, that's like Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, sure, and Voyager, you find out in Next Generation, basically, you know, Picard's era, everything is smoothed out. The Federation is an established thing. It's not just 5-year missions that Kirk is using to run into bad guys and freak out. But when you hit Deep Space Nine, that's like when the kind of shit hits the fan. Mm-hmm. Right, that's like when this Federation that's been so wonderful and so, you know, set up is under a serious threat. And I feel like that kind of pressure is what I'm feeling when I'm watching the vault now, mm-hmm, especially because mm-hmm. it's relatively leaderless. And then, of course, you know, Lucy and the ghoul and her trying to understand why this person is the way they are. That's all great. And then, you know, Thaddeus and there's kind of a weird buddy cop thing going on with Thaddeus and Maximus, even though Thaddeus doesn't know the true story of Maximus. So all of it was great. It was great.
Tosin, how about yourself? What did you think in general about this episode?
I thought it was pretty solid. It was great to finally hear about Coop's back story and a little glimpse into, you know, some of the things that he dislikes about himself or dislikes about what he provided to the world. So I think it was a fairly solid episode. I think it's on the same path as the other episodes.
Yeah, I felt like this episode had, for me, like a lot of like complex meat on its bones to talk about. A lot of stuff, you know, I think last episode there was a lot of sort of
plot moves but not character,
and there's a lot of, for me, I felt there was a lot of character depth, and I'm hoping that we'll get into that in our salient points, first let me drop the usual disclaimer about our analysis here. All the episodes are available on Amazon Prime, but we're only going to be discussing what we learned in this particular episode and in the episodes prior to this one. We're not going to discuss plot points ahead of this episode, or if we do, it's going to be purely from our speculation, not from having watched ahead. All right, let's get into some of the salient points here. I think this was the prologue to this was fascinating analysis of like Cooper's backstory. He doesn't want to shoot his co-star villain because for him it doesn't represent the values of the heroic classical Western hero that he's used to, and his director, who by the way is British, not American, describes to him what essentially happened in our world, this shift in the 1950s from classical Westerns to revisionist Westerns,
anti-hero Westerns.
Yes. Well, they depict a morally questionable world where the lines between heroes and villains are blurred. And it's also interesting that this director mentions that the previous, the writer who had to be let go because he was found to be communist, because once again, this mirrors something that happened in our reality.
The Red Scare in Hollywood.
With the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was basically a kangaroo court set up by the U.S. by U.S. Congress to root out a communist that really didn't exist. It really didn't uncover any actual communists. It was just sort of a way to make Congress people feel good about themselves.
It was also strange because, you know, the country is supposed to be free, so you should be able to do whatever you want. Right, you know, there's the whole free speech thing and all that stuff. So the idea that, like, being having a political party means that you're canceled effectively. That was a weird thing. But what we're seeing here is that just the threat, just the look of an actor, writer, or the studio of the movie being tied to communism changes everything they do, including going from being something that, you know, the kids are watching this. I wear gold and blue and have tassels, and I'm a sheriff, and I'm supposed to shoot the bad guy in the head.
you know? The morals of my world are very, are supposed to be very clear cut.
Right. I mean, he's going from Superman to, like, you know, the worst parts of the Punisher.
Right. Exactly.
It's very interesting because we talked in previous episodes about innocence and loss of innocence. Mm-hmm. And we see Coop as a good man and not being able to kill, but we know that the world has changed him, right? We are the audience, and we know, as the director says, even a good man as yourself can be driven too far.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great Doctor Who episode called A Good Man Goes to War, and a big piece of that episode is this kind of like monologue that River Song drops about how, you know, the doctor's always trying to find a way to make things right. But when you get to a point where he has to go to war, then everybody has to watch out, because when you've driven someone that far to the point where they're kind of like pushing past their typical ideals and they have to like now go for broke, then you got a real problem, and you don't even know what's gonna happen, what they're capable of doing. And I think that is definitely what we see from Cooper the Ghoul versus, you know, Howard Cooper, or Cooper Howard.
Cooper Howard.
Yeah.
And underscoring that idea of Cooper, of pre-apocalypse Cooper's ideals being so clear-cut, so black and white, we have that moment with his wife where his wife, we see, is someone who appreciates subtlety and nuance. She gives him this lavender taffy, and the lavender taffy is something that is delicate, that is nuanced, that has some complexity to it.
And isn't it awful though?
I mean, I don't know. I've never had a lavender taffy.
Aren't they like, she like tricks him?
But that's, but he cannot, for him, it's too complex for him. That, I mean,
he,
I
likes
think
the
that
saccharine, yeah.
He likes things to be very clear cut one way or the other.
Which is a part of America, right? They're like, yeah. not actual America, but part of, like, I think the perception of America around the world is that, you know, these plucky buckaroos that are just all about doing the right thing,
right?
Or what they see as the right thing. And I think that was definitely 1960s America.
One of the other things I noticed is that the chip in Wilzig's head has this self-defense mechanism, and then it shocks Lucy. So it's like, clearly it's like something that does not want to give up its secrets until it's ready, or until it
has the right stimulus or whatever.
Yes. So it's sort of like, it's kind of like the overall subtext that I'm getting for that is that I am not ready to tell you the secret until you are ready to learn the secret. You know, it's like that old adage about when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Like when you're ready to know how to pass the self-defense mechanism of the chip, then you will be able to access it.
I wish that were the case with tests as a kid, because I feel like, you know, the test should only show up when I'm ready. Instead, I was cramming, but whatever.
Also, there's a lot of really interesting stuff here with between Thaddeus and Maximus. So Squire Thaddeus is subservient. Maximus, disguised as Titus, He has the opportunity to kill him to prevent him from revealing his identity, but he spares him. And but still it treats Thaddeus as he was treated by Titus. He repeats that whole clean my jock moment we saw in 102.
Yeah, he hazes him.
He hazes him. He enjoys that feeling of power because it's a feeling that he didn't have access to when he was back at the Brotherhood of Steel camp. He was being hazed himself. You know,
right? Thaddeus is one of the ringleaders.
Right, exactly.
For the whole thing. And Thaddeus talks about it a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He talks ahead, about, you know, ultimately it's kind of like the cycle of bullying.
For sure.
Thaddeus, Maximus, and prior to him, he was bullied. And it continues here. You know, Maximus does not let up. But unlike, you know, where the pattern diverges a little bit, changes a little bit, the maze changes a little bit, is in this case, you know, unlike Maximus still has his ideals of what a knight should be, and he, although he's ultimately like a bumbling kind of a sucker, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, I'll pay extra if you do this fast. He still does, you know, take the first step into unknown danger and tells his squire to stay behind and also saves his squire, right? Rather than letting the squire take the initial hit. Letting the squire figure out what the danger is. Right. So from that regard, he still has this sort of elevated self, and still, even though he continues to get beat up from one group to the other, what still makes him heroic, I guess, is his willingness to always get back up and his willingness to, you know, stand guard.
Right. Yeah, there was this moment at the, you know, with the gulper, and he's like, you know, Daddy's like, you saved me. You yeah. saved me, right? And he's like almost incredulous. And I'm getting the feeling that one of the reasons why, you know, like Maximus didn't think that that the knights could be cruel or selfish, but Thaddeus was like, why wouldn't you be cruel or selfish? Like, why wouldn't you have sacrificed
right.
me
right.
there?
It's the way of the wasteland.
Right, exactly. Also, maybe Thaddeus was just more clued in, because remember, Maximus was the new guy. That's why he was yeah. getting bullied. So maybe Thaddeus was more clued in to how knights treat squires and stuff. That's why he's more subservient, whereas Thaddeus is like, Maximus had been like, hey, so I know what kind of, yeah, that's a cool lining you got there. Let's be friends. Thaddeus is like, I'll do whatever you say. Yeah. Yes, sir. Oh, there's no apples. I have a snack in my bag if you want, you know, that kind of thing. I have rations. So there's like a different thing there. And I think once Maximus realizes that Thaddeus isn't all bad.
Right.
And also once he realizes that, you know, he's part of Thaddeus's class. So, you know, if he had killed Thaddeus, A, he'd be alone again. Who knows who they'd send.
Sure.
And then B, this, you know, there's something to being with somebody, right? And there's clearly a bond when lives are saved.
Right.
You got to give it up. Like, just like when Knight Titus was being attacked by the bear, it was Maximus who actually killed the bear. In this case, you've got Thaddeus who, like, he's like, hey, get out of here. He's got the armor. He's looking up. He's like, oh, my gosh, I'm going to end up like Knight Titus. And Thaddeus takes the 50 cal or whatever weapon mm-hmm. it is. And he, like, just like, you know, he does a shot at the right time. Just like how Maximus had done when he was a squire, to at least throw the beast off. That said, I don't really know how the gulper died.
I think he got his tongue pulled out.
Okay.
Yeah, our fingers.
Yeah.
But, finishing off with those two characters, it is interesting when you look at, once again, looking at names, right? Maximus is kind of Latin for largest or greatest, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Which he tries to embody, even though he may not be most skilled. And Thaddeus is, I think in Greek, is like heart or gift. And you can kind of see this, you know, kind of like a Lucy-like light in this individual who still sees the knights as being this fantastic thing of benevolence, even though there are times sure. he's like questioning some of his decision making, like in the questioning like, oh, you let him live. Oh, there must have been a reason for that, you know? So
I think also Thaddeus bows to power more than Maximus did. Right? So he's like, you're in charge. You're strong. You're big. And I feel like I've seen that before in the real world. Like, well, they're, you know, they've, you know, this person has all the money, so they must be right, kind of thing. And so when it comes to Thaddeus, he's like, there's got to be a reason for this, and therefore I'm going to like rationalize the reason. Oh yeah, we can track them. Perfect. And it's unclear what they were actually tracking, because when they got to the lake, you know, the dude wasn't there.
I sense you were tracking. Didn't he say something about an abomination? Because Thaddeus was like, there might be a bigger abomination here, or a different abomination.
Right. I think what happened was they were tracking the signature that the ghoul puts off, because maybe they're irradiated. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to the pond, they're just tracking irradiation.
Maybe the radiation. Gulper is
the
also,
gulper has more radiation, so it kind of went there. So that was interesting. But
I do like that in this situation where Titus would have sent Maximus in as cannon fodder, like we saw in episode 102, Maximus decides to uphold a more chivalrous code than he was treated to and face the gulper himself. This is a turn in Maximus's character arc.
Well, I think it also ties back into what we were saying last week when we were talking about how much is the world going to change them from their ideals?
Right.
And since Maximus is like, hey, the ideal of a knight, Titus, you don't deserve to wear this armor.
Exactly.
I deserve to wear this armor, and therefore I'm going to take this hit. I'm going to take it because that's the right thing to do. And I think that was a good statement of Maximus' character.
We learned in this episode that whoever gets the target will control the wasteland. That's what Thaddeus told Maximus, which is interesting. I think that's an interesting point that we did not know, that whatever it is that is in Dr. Wilzig's head is something that will allow whoever owns it to control the wasteland.
Yeah, I mean, Wilzig said himself before he died due to, you know, Plan D.
You could change the world with this.
Yeah, it'll change the future is what
change
he said.
Change the future, you're right.
Yeah, so he says, I want to change, what's in here will change the future. So that ties in exactly. So I just, again, I really hope it's a concrete thing and not some, smoke monster from Lost that they actually know exactly what this is going to be.
You would have known what the smoke monster was if you finished the rest of the series.
I saw what the smoke monster was. It wasn't satisfactory. it was nebulous. My point is, it was a nebulous and abstract thing. I need this to be a concrete thing, like they can't pull freaking Hope out of his head.
This is true. I thought it was interesting that when Lucy first gets to the Hollywood Lake, she sees this fawn, which is like this symbol of natural harmony in this chaotic world.
And innocence.
And she's like, oh, the world is just like I imagined it would be when I came out of the vault. There is still like a glimmer of purity and harmony. And then almost immediately that fawn gets swallowed by the gulper.
Right. It's also like a bit of a dig at Disney, the way I saw it.
Oh, sure.
Because remember, Lucy is the daughter of the overseer, right? So she's effectively
a princess.
Yeah, so she's a princess. She's on her adventure where she's going to, like, she meets the prince, the knight, and she's on her adventure to, like, save her father, whatever. But at the end of the day, all those Disney princesses, or at least many of them, had this affinity for wild animals that they could pacify, not unlike, the virgin and the unicorn. And that's an old story you guys should definitely check out. And basically that moment is happening, and then this monster comes and eats the thing. And once again, her innocence is getting bitten away piece by piece by this world. And that's, to me, that was funny. That was a funny, like, dig at the Disney situation.
Yeah. And once again, she's still has some of that innocence, right? She's lighting a fire when she's been warned by our now headless foe.
Yeah, Wilzig was like, dude, you're going to get in trouble if you light a fire. I mean, there was a cockroach coming right for her before that dog saved her.
Yeah,
and so she's still doing that now. However, ironically, Wilzig was the guy who actually lost his head rather than her. But, you know, I think throughout this episode, one thing that was kind of interesting to me is there is a bit of Lucy kind of accepting the world a little bit further here, right? She actually lies to the ghoul about not knowing where the head is when she clearly has a tracker on her. She clearly was tracking it previously. She specifically, but you know, she's getting torn a bit, you know, her Fallout or her Vault 33 like clothing is no longer in pieces, and so with that comes the lies.
Oh man, I like lost it when she lost her boot. Cuz like I'm not like just cuz like the idea of being, I don't know, I'm from New York and I used to get skeeved out when people would wear sandals just because like it's dirty. And the idea of being in this wasteland with irradiated stuff everywhere and not having like a shoe, like she didn't even have a sock on. She's just barefoot. You know what I mean? It's just like,
and had gulper stuff all over her.
Yeah. Foot. Gulper slime all over her. Like it was like, you know, it was kind of like this rock bottom moment. In addition to her being vulnerable, I mean, he was using her as bait,
right?
You know? So this kind of like rock bottom moment, gulper thing. And she lost the shoe and it was just like, in her own head, like, this shit is real, right? So she lost her shoe, he lost his medicine. It was kind of like the beginning of a kind of darkest before the dawn situation, you know? Everybody's in trouble.
Right. Things have gone bad for all of our heroes.
Yeah. So I just want to say with the gulper.
Yeah. Which is like, it's like a cross between an axolotl and oddly a human somehow. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's different from the gulpers in the show, in the game. They redesigned the gulper. There's many different types of gulpers, and this is not any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really like the fingers were just wonderfully unsettling. I think it was also funny. Like the later at the end of the episode. The face, because you know Maximus sees Lucy, and you know Lucy's not, you know, she's easy on the eyes, and Maximus is like, yeah, I could save her. That's right, you know. and then he sees her boot in the gulper's vomit, and you see his face. He's like, oh, you know, like the world is that rough. So when they do meet up again, if they do meet up again, I'm pretty sure they're probably gonna meet up again. I'm going to be excited as to what he's feeling about meeting up with her. Right. And, you know, if this is any kind of like any other TV we've ever seen, the circumstances of the meeting up will have her unhappy with him. So we'll see how it works out. But yeah, those are the things that stuck out for me. Those fingers.
I want to go over some of the dynamics that we learned in Vault 33. So we start off and we see Chet, getting fired from his job as like vault guardian, which causes
was hilarious. Can we talk about that for a moment?
So
he's like crying behind the door,
right?
And then he comes out and like in that kind of like Midwestern fashion of like hiding your emotions, like I'll be fine. And then he's like honest about it. They're all honest. They're super honest people.
Right.
Like, it just turns out that, you know, opening the gate, opening the vault
exactly
makes being guardian of the vault
right.
You know, it's incompatible. I can't be both.
Well, that's what it was about that for me is that, you know, that to me tells me that his entire identity is tied to.
I don't even
his
know
role.
Who I am anymore.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, "I really am not really sure who I am anymore."
Well, he lost two things. He lost Lucy, who he thinks he's in love with.
Yeah.
And he lost his position. So it's like, you know, and also the world kind of ended in that vault for a minute. So you get it.
Right.
But also there's this great like TV trope of big, strong men being super vulnerable and crying. And that's exactly what's happening right there.
But I feel like that's sort of indicative of like everyone in Vault 33 right now, their entire identities are tied to what their role in the vault is. And Chet is like the first, He's the canary in the coal mine of like, oh my God, this vault really could fall once their innocence, once their collective innocence has been ruined, which we see.
So yes, yes, and I agree with that, but yes and no, because on the one hand, they juxtapose him with Norm, right?
Sure.
And Norm's identity is not at all tied to what he does.
Sure.
Because everything Norm does, you know, he lacks enthusiasm. So he doesn't care about his role in the vault. He doesn't even seem, I mean, he likes to play the video games, but he doesn't even seem to care about them super much, a lot, right? He'll play the video games. He liked to be around his family. You know, he could have hidden in a corner and played his video games, but he wanted to be around them when they were talking and stuff. The fact is, you've got people like Chet who seem like vault standard, and then you've got someone like Norm. His name is Norm, but he's the most abnormal
person
in the vault, right? And then you've got the fact that he's like, okay, well, you know, you could demote me, but that's kind of impossible because I don't
have
a good job.
Fire me?
You know, exactly. And then on top of all of that, you know, he looks at his cousin Chet and he sees him getting demoted. He's like, well, I'm glad is the accountability just limited to the people who follow the rules? Or are you going to deal out some of this accountability to the people who came in here and killed us? And when he brings that up in the room with the council, you know, the elder councilwoman, I forgot her name. She's like, I see where you're getting at.
Yeah.
I'm kind of down with that.
Yeah.
But then when he brings it up in front of everybody else, she's forced to say in the public, she's like, we're not seriously thinking about killing these people. And you're like, the minute she says, you're like, oh, y'all gonna kill these people.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to me.
Norm is like the guy in the classic parable about the cave, where, you know, the people who are inside the cave only see the shadows of from the light in the cave, and they have no idea what it's really like. And Norm is like that one guy who actually looked outside the cave and saw what real life was, and now he's developing a cynicism about it. He was never enthusiastic about vault life, and now he's beginning to question Vault 33's entire leadership structure and his place in this structured system.
There's also the fact that, just hop on that moment right there, which you said, remember, it must have been first or second episode where he said, you know, if it was the first episode, he's like, well, they don't want you to go look for dad, because if he comes back, they don't get to be overseer.
Exactly.
So he recognizes the political ramifications of what's going on in a way that most people maybe aren't thinking about. And that is part of his motivation for sort of undermining the authority of these three hapless council people.
He recognizes the dissent amongst the vault leaders. You know, he knows that power, he recognizes that power can be corruptive. And the two other council members, Woody and Reg, they both want control. He sees that. And so he begins to put a little,
set them against each other.
Yeah, set them against each other a little bit. He knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, when you first meet him, he seems like he's the black sheep.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But now, and this is what made this episode so great, you realize he's just as smart as Lucy. Maybe he's even more clever when it comes to these small things. And his dad was overseer, so he saw how leadership worked. So, and he saw how leadership worked, and he saw how the vault worked. So, you know, I think now that we know that there's only 2 months of water left or whatever it is, I'm interested in seeing how he handles that.
When they're talking about rehabilitating the Raiders, Norm immediately recognizes that is a futile effort, maybe a futile effort. And then
it's a shit plan. That's
a terrible plan. But even if it was an effort with some sort of purpose, to what end would that result? Like the Raiders, they have no sense of value, not the same sense of value that the vaulties have. So
they're just exploiters. Like, if you think about it, if you, knowing what you know about our world, knowing that the world was destroyed, Tosin, knowing that you know, you found a way into Vault 31, would you slaughter them all, like Mad Max style, which is what happened, or would you be like, hey, we're going to find ways to be useful to the society so we can be in here and not have to leave, right? That's how, like, a rational person from our way of thinking would land.
Right.
But the vaulters are like, the surface dwellers are like just, you know, even more defiant, even though they're locked up.
Sure.
And they have the upper hand, right? They're like, hey, you're feeding me.
Yes.
You're feeding me. You're keeping me strong. And I'm in here healing from whatever wounds I got during that battle. And the moment I get out, I'm just going to rip you apart again.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Norm understands that that sometimes the punishment has to fit the crime, which I don't think the rest of Vault 33 has evolved to that sense of value.
I mean, they're talking about, hey, man, they're just misunderstood. Yeah. You know, they never had a proper education. I think we should start with Kant.
They're operating in the context of dealing with other vaulties.
Exactly. It was wild. It was like being in an Amherst first year seminar.
But I think, you know, once the reality of their water and other situation comes to light, mm-hmm. you know, things when reality sets, people change, right?
Yeah, I was saying it before
in the first episode.
When your belly is full, it's easy to be like, hey, everything's fine. But they say, you know, there's this old phrase, like, you know, a revolution's only 3 meals away.
That's right. That's right. Last couple things I wanted to point out. At the epilogue at the end, where we go back to Cooper in the before times, it's clear that the Vault Tech execs and Cooper's wife seem to be aware that the Vault Tech suit isn't as radiation proof as they've advertised.
What was that about? I mean, I didn't really get it.
It seemed like Cooper's wife wanted him to have the opportunity to advertise for them. And I feel like Cooper, once again, it represented Cooper coming from this black and white value system before the fall, before the apocalypse, where if the Vault Tech equipment was not as reliable as advertised, he would have turned down the sponsorship shop.
Right. But you know what also is weird? So he's at the party in the beginning, and he's doing the party, and the one guy's like, he does parties, and he's like, why else? Alimony. But then he's married. Mm. So she's his second wife?
No. This is before that party, because that party happened just before the apocalypse. So
that must have been before the party. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so possible that was alimony. Mm-hmm. You know, the alimony is a real thing. But when I put that in the context of doing the commercial, it's like these side hustles for a Hollywood man.
Yeah.
Of that era, didn't seem to make sense. But
Maybe he decided not to shoot the person, and he got outed. He got let go.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe, you know, the Vault Tech commercials didn't go right, and he had an argument with his wife, and they all broke up. But I guess what I'm saying is, it's interesting to see that he's doing this side stuff. Whether it's, you know, these things, it's very interesting. And also, you're right, it must have been before, because he's doing the thumbs up.
Yeah.
But he can't do the thumbs up later.
Right.
So that's that was really quite interesting.
I think it's darkly ironic that he was the one that came up with that thumbs up pose that then became the corporate gesture of the Vault Tech mascot.
Right. He basically like creative directed the whole thing. Right. like kind of not really knowing. So it's very interesting. Also, what is his wife's connection with Vault Tech? That is a mystery.
That is a good question. Do you have any other unanswered questions besides that one?
I mean, I mentioned it last week. The whole squire thing is weird.
Right. About having a squire that doesn't have his own method of transport, that has to carry around this bag, when clearly the way it should work is like Master Blaster from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, right? Like the squire should be riding on the shoulders of the knight.
Of the knight. Until you get into a fight, then go hide. Right. So I don't know. I saw it again this episode. I was like, ah. All right, into the big picture then.
Yeah, so far, the narrative of the Vault Dwellers and Cooper's backstory seem to be more compelling to me than the narrative of the Brotherhood of Steel. I don't know if any of you guys find that. I feel like we're, you know, because I think we just haven't seen enough of what's going on with the Brotherhood of Steel outside of our one knight and our one squire. I would love the.
I want to see more of that too. I felt like that here because the Brotherhood is still there's some darkness there, right? You saw it mentioned with the Knight Titus. He's like, what the heck are we getting fighting all this stuff to get right. a toaster oven for? What is going on with these clerics that are just so sanctimonious? And then I'm out here fighting
right,
and dying.
Right.
So I think there needs to be more of that. It's kind of, I feel like way about Dune too. I saw Dune 2 part 2. I was like, hey, can you show me more of these great houses and like why I should care about them?
Right.
And so when it comes to the Enclave, when it comes to the Brotherhood of Steel, show me the characters in there so I know who these protagonists are up against, or at least I know their motivations. So, but I mean, maybe we'll have time for that because you got some stuff in the ephemera we can talk about.
Yeah. So going to the sort of the larger theme of idealism versus realism that I introduced in the last episode. So Lucy still believes that the golden rule applies in the wasteland, as she explains to the ghoul, you know, because of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is still part of her idealism. And
I mean, it's a pretty magnetic rule. Like once you hear that, it's really hard to give it up.
Sure. Sure.
You know,
And also like Thaddeus beat the shit out of Maximus. Not because it was personal, but because that behavior was generational. It helped you evolve past getting the shit beat out of you. If you could pass that treatment down to the next generation, it establishes like a kind of a hierarchy.
That, and yeah. I think it's the hierarchy. Plus, it's also like once you get accepted, you're part of the team, and you get to deal out the shit to
right,
like
exactly.
the lone wolf.
It's like the
you know so the.
The world's worst multi-level marketing scheme.
Yes. Hazing is the world's worst multi-level marketing scheme. I agree.
And lastly, like Vault 33 Council says, you can judge a person and a society by how they treat their enemy. And so they're attempting to impress their ideals to lay their ideals onto the context of the Raiders, who there is no idealism for the Raiders. So I feel like they're going to find that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, they're going to fuck around.
I mean, it's like the other, right? And it's we've seen it a lot in how some people think about, you know, political situation here in the
right.
U.S. and other things where there's different philosophies at play. We'll see if there's judgment calls based off of what happens. But I also feel like we're going to get into another one of these Lord of the Flies in my belief, that ultimately there's already this struggle for who holds the conch shell. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it's going to really delve into just madness and chaos, and this Vault will not be this idealized place that it was. And maybe we even discover that some of the failures why the other vaults opened and let people outside were because of the same sort of struggles.
Yeah, so one thing I want to bring up in the big picture is this you know, we're talking about idealism, we're talking about all this other stuff. We're talking about you know, who these guys are and the changes, right?
Yeah.
And one big thing here is when the director says, you know, because out here, it's just you, your gun, and your postal code bringing order to the Wild Wild West, right? That's Emil, the director of Cooper's movie. And you could take that same line and apply that to the wasteland. That's out here, it's just you, your gun, your personal code bringing order to the wasteland. And that, to me, is the opposite of the golden rule. Right. So she's right. moving by the golden rule. And, you know, Cooper Howard has turned into Cooper the Ghoul, and he's out there moving to his code. Right. His code is save a dog if you can, get the head, even if you have to use the girl's right. bait.
Well,
you know,
I think also, but the personal
Maximus
code
is in the middle.
Right. Right. He's like the neutral. right?
Yeah, he's a little bit of like he's like lawful neutral.
Lawful right? neutral, whereas, right?
Right. Whereas Lucy's trying to be lawful good, and the ghoul is basically like
chaotic
evil? Something, chaotic neutral maybe. But at the end of the day, his chaotic neutral situation is like, I got my personal code, and that's what I'm using right. to get what I have to get. And the question is Maximus going to pull more toward the ghoul mm-hmm. or pull more toward Lucy? Right. And it'd be interesting to see how that shakes out. Because with Maximus, it's either or, right? Again, he's not the best.
Right. Right.
But he's trying. Right. That's right. What we got.
Maximus is aware of the chaos of the wasteland. He just operates via a different code in a context to it than Lucy does, and certainly than Cooper does. And for Cooper, his personal code,
Cooper is an agent of the context of the craziness.
He's
an
agent of chaos for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like the chaos of the wasteland is partly because people like Cooper exist.
Yes, but his personal code altered from before the apocalypse to now to current times.
Exactly. So I thought that was a big, like, looking at these characters mm-hmm. is because this is the first time I've seen them on that continuum, like Lucy as the lawful good
for sure,
and the ghoul as the chaotic neutral. We don't have a chaotic evil here, right? I guess the
Moldaver
could be, yeah, maybe Moldaver's chaotic evil. That's true. Moldaver could be chaotic evil, but we don't know her reasoning yet.
We don't have
anyone who rolls into a spot and indiscriminately kills a whole bunch of innocent people.
Yeah.
You know, her team took out the eye of a pregnant lady. Chaotic evil. You know, that could be it. You know, she could be chaotic evil. I'll give you that. But yeah, it's a humdinger. We're gonna see kind of where they end up. Anyway, technical aspects.
Yeah, so this is where we talk about some of the behind-the-scenes elements we enjoyed in this episode: music, acting, visual effects. And I just want to say that I've been really impressed with the ghoul makeup, particularly his nose, because as I understand...
Oh my god, is it CGI or something?
Yeah, is what I mean, is how you shoot these scenes usually is... And I have not seen any behind-the-scenes footage, but the way I understand how you shoot these scenes, is that you got Walton Goggins dressed up in all of his makeup, but in place of his nose, they've got like basically a green fabric covering the parts of his nose that aren't desiccated in the ghoul makeup. And then afterwards, they have to do post-processing and go over every shot that he's in with the green nose and incorporate the CGI cavity, which is a phenomenal amount of work. And so it's very impressive because it's flawless. Because
we've come a long way since like Batman, Superman, whatever.
Right.
Where his mustache was removed and it looked so creepy.
Right. But to see like this cavity that moves in perspective with his head is just really, really impressive to me.
Yeah.
So props. And I wanted to mention that like the way when Maximus is talking to the Brotherhood over the comm link and he is like they're like, we're gonna send another squire by, and he pulls the comm link out and he's like, no, we're doing fine here, everything's fine, everything is okay. That was like,
who does that remind
that
you
was
of?
A yeah. straight up lift from Han Solo in the detention block in Star Wars A New Hope.
Yeah, totally. It was brilliant. It was really, really quite good. He like just, he doesn't shoot it, but he steps
no.
out. He's like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's good shit. It's really good shit.
All right. Let's talk about some ephemera. These are links and extra textual connections that help enhance your enjoyment of this episode. Dwayne, you've got something.
Yeah. So, I was checking out thegamer.com and they had a great little article on every creature from the game that appears in the show.
Yeah.
And the Gulper, right? It was there. And they say the Gulper received a whole new concept in the show. The games feature many different types of Gulper enemy varieties, but the one created for the Flawless show could easily blow all those out of the water. This creature has lighter pink coloration, similar to the Scorched Gulper, but with more axolotl-esque features mm-hmm. and the face, around the face, perhaps most distinct, its mouth consists of human fingers instead of teeth. It was very, what's the movie? It's very I Am Legend feeling. The weirdness of the Gulper. The Gulper fight is a pivotal set piece in episode 3, which happens between a power-armored Maximus as well as Lucy and the Ghoul. And they say more, but that goes beyond the scope of what we're talking about here.
We'll have the article linked in our show notes.
Yeah, there you go.
Tosin, how about you?
Yeah, so I mentioned Lord of the Flies, which is a 1954 book by William Golding, around a group of boys, I think they're British, who were stranded on an island, and it kind of, in their attempts to govern themselves, it devolves into madness. Nice.
We predict that that's what's going to happen to our vaulties.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They will become the world that they had so dreaded of and tried to avoid.
And lastly, I wanted to mention that we got the news from Hollywood Reporter that Fallout has officially been renewed for season 2 by Amazon Prime. So if you like our coverage so far of Fallout, then you'll probably be seeing more of us, hearing more of us in season 2 after this season's over.
That was reported last week.
So
I'm pretty excited because it'll give them time to, like, again, build out some of these cool things. I don't need more prequel stuff, but like building out like what's happening in the vault, building out the Brotherhood of Steel, building out the Enclave, all that could be useful.
For sure. And there's enough world building in there, enough world building in the game franchise to really get some meat on this bone here, figuratively speaking. And that's going to do it for this episode of Vault 33. I'm going to go around the table and I'm going to ask, I'll start with you, Dwayne, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not talking about Fallout on Amazon Prime?
Yeah, just check me out on Twitter.com or X, Dwayne D, or Instagram, Dwayne D. Tosin, what about you?
You can find me at Instagram at BurntToast45. What about yourself, Andy?
My X handle is Mr. Babyman. You can find everything I'm liking and linking there. Our Twitter handle for the show, once again, is Fallout Vault 33. We're on all the major podcast distribution networks. Add us, tell your friends. And join us next time when we cover the fourth episode of Fallout entitled The Ghouls. Until then, please tweet us and leave us a comment on iTunes, and we will see you soon.
Yeah, I wonder what that episode's going to be about. Thanks, guys. Why don't you crawl out to the Fallout back to